Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What about Money for Nothing, Dire Straits?
Oh, very nice. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, that's good too.
Okay, well, with that in mind, David, why don't you kick things off?
Okay, I'm going to start in 2 seconds. Everybody ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hello and welcome to Alpha Chat. I'm David Johann and I'm joined by Isabella Kaminska in Geneva. Hi, Izzy.
Hi, everybody.
Our guest today is Scott Skirm, a leading repo and securities financing expert and author of The Money Noose, John Corzine and the Collapse of MF Global. It's kind of timely having him on because there is a tiny bit of news out of the civil trial, which is shockingly Corzine rejects all allegations that he acted with gross negligence. It's not shocking. But it is a really good entry into Scott's book because he makes kind of the point, or you make the point, Scott, that the media has sensationalized many of the wrong points about this case and about MF Global's collapse. Maybe we didn't pay enough attention to some of the more systemic issues and some of the things that were flashing red for a long time. This was maybe less a bankruptcy fueled by a bad trade on European sovereign debt and more a story of bad risk management, ego, and, you know, John Corzine building an empire. Is that fair?
On the surface, as you said, it's very much portrayed as a story of a trade gone bad. But in reality, in depth in the story, is that, you know, there were a lot of issues that contributed to MF Global's collapse, and a lot of mistakes that were made by John Corzine, and there was certainly a lot of things that could have done better. And I think at this point now is that regulators and the trustees are at the point where they've gone through the records of MF Global and they've gone through the business and they've looked at the mistakes that were made, and now they're looking for somewhat of a scapegoat or somebody to blame. And I think that's where we are with a civil complaint that was filed against John Corzine and Edith O'Brien.
So I guess it's coming across as a bit of a witch hunt. And what I find interesting is that in the book, obviously, you talk a lot about corporate culture within MF Global. And actually, you start the story back with the Refco acquisition. So I was just wondering, like, could you explain how actually, in some ways, this predates even the entry point of Corzine?
In 2006, there was a company that was an MF Global company called Man Financial, which was part of the three companies of the original Man Financial Group. And Man Financial was hunting around for an acquisition in the United States because they had been mostly based in London, and they were looking to expand into the United States and acquire a futures business here. So as it turns out, just around the time when they were looking for an acquisition and looking to grow, Refco had gone bankrupt, and there was fraud involved in the case, and there was what they call round-trip loans. And Refco had just done an IPO where they raised a lot of money. There was fraud, and there were three bidders for the Refco business. And Man Financial was, as it seemed at the time, the one that was lucky enough to purchase the business. When Man Financial purchased Refco, they inherited the alternative method, which is one reason why the futures cash number went from it increased so much after they went under.
Yeah, so you had this company, Refco, with another kind of shell game cash situation, but then you had MF Global. And
right.
Even before Corzine arrived, he was having risk and capital issues. And in many ways, that's why Corzine was, that was his window in, wasn't it? Because you had this kind of problem of rogue trading within MF Global that allowed Corzine to come in. And it was at the same time they needed capital as an IPO, which also made MF Global kind of vulnerable to credit rating agencies and put so much pressure on Corzine.
Oh, absolutely, David. And it's kind of an interesting story there, was that Evan Dooley was the MF Global rogue trader who at nighttime on his laptop computer in the Memphis MF Global office was able to attempt to corner the overnight wheat futures trading market. And not only did he do it once, he actually did it twice, which led to some headlines and a $141 million loss. And what happened, that was actually the February of 2008. In March of 2008, Bear Stearns had gone under, and there was a lot of pressure on independent brokers in the U.S. And after the Evan Dooley rogue trading incident and pressure in the markets from Bear Stearns, it brought in J.C. Flowers to make an investment in MF Global. And that investment, which, of course, J.C. Flowers thought it was the best investment deal, one of the best deals they had negotiated in a long time. J.C. Flowers was a former Goldman Sachs partner, and that investment ultimately led to his J.C. Flowers relationship with John Corzine, and John Corzine coming into MF Global 2 years later.
I think one of the other things that struck me was you really don't seem to think John Corzine is a particularly bad guy.
You know, John Corzine certainly made a lot of mistakes at MF Global. There is no doubt about that. And I think, you know, somebody who came from being the senior partner at Goldman to being senator of New Jersey, governor of New Jersey, I think they had a lot of faith in themselves. And I think John Corzine had a large ego. And, you know, as one MF Global executive told me, quote, at Goldman Sachs, John Corzine was challenged. At MF Global, John Corzine was worshipped. And that created a whole culture within MF Global where John Corzine pretty much did what he wanted. You know, if he wanted to spec trade, he had a proprietary trading group that he was running, and he was trading all day long. If the risk manager, Mike Roseman, was not approving John Corzine's trading limits to increase them, John Corzine arranged for Mike Roseman to be moved out of the company.
That was a fascinating moment, I thought, the removal of Roseman when they were trying to get these repo to maturity trades, like the limits lifted, and they had this guy who was brought in to say no, and then they got in a yes man. It just really solidified what Corzine was in the firm.
And I've worked with Mike Roseman before, and I know him personally. And, you know, I discussed at MF Global how Mike Roseman, he believed in saying no. So he was a risk manager that was very tight on risk approvals. Now, he gave people risk numbers and risk limits, and a lot of time you had to sit down with him and negotiate and discuss them. But he was the overall company's risk manager, and when he started saying no to John Corzine, you know, it created a lot of conflict, and Mike Roseman gave some larger limits. But at one point, he had decided that he had estimated that with the repo to maturity book, that if you take their positions, which this is probably the end of 2010, and
I wonder if you might have it just explained the repo to maturity trade, just for anyone who isn't familiar with it.
So I can buy a bond from you, David, and I can sell a bond to Isabella. And I will have bought a bond, I will have sold a bond. Hopefully I made money buying and selling. And once that transaction is completed, it's over. It's just part of the records. Now, financial markets have changed a lot in the course of the past 20, 30, 40 years, and have become more complicated, where there's other ways of buying and selling securities. Certainly there's derivatives, and that can be a whole other story and a whole other question and discussion. But in terms of this aspect, in the repo market, you can also, instead of selling a bond to somebody, you can loan a bond to somebody. So let's say I bought a 10-year bond from you and I loaned it to Isabella overnight, I would get that bond back the next day and I've still owned it. So in a repo to maturity trade, let's say that I bought that same bond from you, David, and then I loaned it to Isabella until it matures. So in other words, you know, I've bought it, but I've loaned it to somebody else. I'm never getting it back because I've loaned it to somebody else until it matures, and then when it matures, they're going to have the bond and they're going to get paid from the issuer. So in a way, a repo to maturity trade is another way of selling a bond. Repo to maturity trades have been trades that people have been doing in the U.S. repo market for years and years and years. And primarily, it was always kind of an arbitrage trade that was done in the treasury market and the agency market, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, AAA securities. And generally, it was done with securities that matured within a couple months. So in other words, if I bought a one-month U.S. treasury from you, David, and loaned it to Isabella for a month, you know, the accounting rules were such that it was a AAA security, it was a buy and a loan to maturity, it was considered an off-balance sheet item. So in other words, it was considered the equivalent of a sale, so that, you know, in AAA U.S. treasuries and very short-term trades, that was considered a purchase and what they call it a true sale under accounting rules. So what happened in the MF Global story was that John Corzine and the traders at MF Global took that trade not just one step further, but maybe two or three steps further. So they noticed, and there are other people in the market, too, that noticed this trade also, but they weren't into it as big as John Corzine was. So at MF Global, they noticed that because of the European debt crisis and starting off with Greece, that there were a lot of European government bonds that were trading at really high yields relative to historical levels. So, for example, the bonds of Spain and Portugal and Ireland and Italy all were trading with really high yields relative to where you can loan them out in the repo market. So they put together this trade so that they would buy the bonds from, you know, out in the market, and then MF Global repoed those bonds to maturity. So kind of like a buy and a sell, but instead of AAA U.S. treasuries that they were trading, which was the traditional repo to maturity trade, they were dealing in AA, single A, European government debt. And instead of doing trades that were 1 month, 2 months at the most, they were going out for a year, sometimes longer than a year. You know, right around the same time as in 2010, when MF Global was gearing up on these trades, there's also the ESFS. So if a country was having problems funding their debt, that the ESFS would come in and help the country with the funding, which almost seemed like, you know, you had the debt of, let's say, Ireland, which, you know, up until that time had been, you know, pretty good country sovereign debt. And it also had a backup facility from the European Union. So it really looked like these trades were what they call, you know, AAA risk-free trades.
They're sensible trades, essentially. Corzine doing a good job as a fixed income trader.
Oh, absolutely. And I think when John Corzine arrived at MF Global, MF Global had about $500 million in these trades on their books.
In European debt or in U.S. treasuries?
In European debt. You know, in potentially both. I never got that number, which side it was, but they definitely had about $500 million on at the time. And here's how the story goes, was that John Corzine had gotten into MF Global, was there a few months, started up their proprietary trading group, and he noticed that there was a hole in their earnings. And basically, the MF Global earnings at the time, they had been losing money, and they continue to lose money. And John Corzine felt that he needed about 18 months to get MF Global back on track and into profitability under his plan. And the rating agencies gave him approximately 1 year or so from when they sat down and had a meeting. So John Corzine realized he needed to have earnings, or he needed at least, you know, stem the losses. John Corzine walked around to all the trading desks in New York, and he basically said, I need to get $20 million a quarter. Do you have any ideas of how we can get there? and of course, the financial markets at the time, this is 2010, you know, we didn't have booming financial markets. We were still recovering from the financial crisis in 2008. And there were not a lot of ideas of where to get that money really quickly in any really good trades. He stopped by the repo desk in New York. They had mentioned that the spreads in the U.S. repo market were pretty thin. And then he started going around to some of the trading desks in London. When he hit the repo desk in London, basically they said, you know, we do have a trade that can make a lot of money. The only problem is we can't get our risk limits increased to add to the size of the trade because Mike Roseman, the risk manager, won't increase our limits. Now, which, of course, you know, for Mike Roseman, you know, he had risk limits in place, and, you know, you have to have a risk limit. So then John Corzine looked at the trade a little further and looked at this European buying Irish bonds, repoing them to maturity, and, you know, realized, and I'll say myself, it was a really good trade. Conceptually, it was a great trade. You were locking in profits. You were theoretically putting trades on your balance sheet, but, of course, at the time, it was a, quote, off-balance sheet trade. So, in other words, the repo to maturity part of it, the sale, was considered off-balance sheet. So, in other words, accountants didn't consider those assets or liability on a bank's balance sheet. So it was off-balance sheet. It was in European sovereign debt, which nobody expected anybody to default, and it was able to make a good chunk of money. So it ticks
all the boxes in many ways. And the funny thing is, and especially the fact that it could be off balance sheet, but then, like, what comes to my mind is that, A, you know, the old adage that markets can stay irrational more longer than you can stay liquid, or in this longer than you can meet margin calls. And also the fact that often arbitrages like that exist because people just can't afford to take them on.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's really interesting here was that, so we put together, as you said, all the pieces of a great trade, but what was the downside? You know, what was the one factor that could sink you on this trade? Because there always is something. And the one factor was that was margin calls. That, you know, when you purchase the bonds, you know, you own them, and you're susceptible to a default, to Ireland defaulting or Spain defaulting. But then on the repo to maturity side, LCH ClearNet, which is the central clearing counterparty for repo trades in Europe, These trades, the repo part of it, the repo to maturity part, still exists. Like, it's still a trade that MF Global had to do something for. So in other words, they had to mark to market that trade. So LCH ClearNet was housing that leg of the trade, and there were margin calls to that trade. So as it turns out, in 2011, when the European debt crisis was really growing, and there was a lot of speculation that some of these countries could default. I mean, Ireland was the first that sold off. But that as these bonds were selling off in price and the prices were declining, LCH ClearNet was calling more and more margin on the repo side of these trades. So, you know, if there's one thing that could destroy the profitability of the trade, was that MF Global had to put up margin to cover the repo leg of this trade.
Is that even destroying the profitability, though? Because they'll get that back at maturity. It's a liquidity trap. Carry on.
Yeah, David, you know, you can look at it two ways. If you want to look at it in a very simple sense, they would get all that money back at the end. And, you know, it was really just money that they had to put up for a period of time where they just didn't have use of that capital. In a more complicated sense, you could say, well, you know, if they're using their capital for repo to maturity trades, then they weren't able to use that capital elsewhere in other businesses. So
that's
there's
very
certainly
fair.
An opportunity cost. And certainly, and here's an aspect I didn't put in the book, but, you know, as MF Global personnel reported to me, by September and October, right before MF Global went under, MF Global had, for example, a mortgage business, and they needed so much capital for the repo to maturity trades that they weren't, the mortgage business was not allowed to carry inventory or carry positions, or if it was, it was just minimal, because they knew that the repo to maturity trades were consuming so much of the company's capital that it was hurting other business lines and preventing them from doing business and growing.
So what was originally supposed to be not a very balanced sheet intensive trade turned out to be very balance sheet intensive, as it soured and it basically sucked up all the capital out of most of the rest of the business.
If we sat down and said, you know, what was the one thing that you can trace back, you know, which the main factor that contributed to MF Global's collapse and demise. You know how they sometimes say, you know, the butterfly flaps its wings in Africa, and that adds to, you know, the hurricane that eventually hits the east coast of the United States because, you know, one little bit of extra wind, you know, added to more wind and everything, you know, like the whole butterfly effect. If there's one little thing that you can trace back, you know, what was that little butterfly wing start that caused a collapse? It was a change in an obscure accounting rule called FASB 140. And FASB 140 is the accounting rule, which is in the United States, which is called the true sale accounting. So in other words, as I was explaining the repo to maturity trade, that's the accounting rule that covers the repo to maturity trade. So in other words, the true sale rule is what's really a true sale. So, you know, with complex financial instruments these days, you know, the financial markets are much more complicated than just, you know, I buy a bond, I sell a bond. Now, there's a lot of ways to buy a bond. There's a lot of ways to sell a bond. So, you know, getting back to the repo maturity, and when I was discussing that, when it was a AAA U.S. Treasury bond repoed to maturity for a month, that was considered a true sale. It's AAA securities, it's short term. But what happened was MF Global took these bonds, you know, took it away from just AAA U.S. treasuries and all of a sudden was dealing with securities that were AA, single A rated. And there was technically some default risk there. And then also instead of for 1 month, you know, doing 1 month trade, they were doing 1 year trades. So what happened was that MF Global's accounting firm and regulators in March of 2011 started looking at the repo to maturity trades and went to MF Global and said, you know what, we're starting to interpret the true sale law a little bit different for your repo to maturity trades. And we've decided that repo to maturity in your circumstances is no longer a true sale. So in that instance, all those repo to maturity bonds that were off balance sheet for MF Global all of a sudden came back on their balance sheet at the end of March of 2011. And then what happened a couple months down the road, September passed and October hit, and then there was a Wall Street Journal article on October 17th which said, oh, by the way, did anyone notice that MF Global was undercapitalized in July? So in combination of that Wall Street Journal article, MF Global, days after that, issued their worst earnings report of down $191 million loss for the quarter before that. And then that set off a whole chain of events, which was basically their bankruptcy. They lost their liquidity and everything that, you know, has been in the news happened right after that. So in a way, you know, like that change and that little known accounting rule had all these consequences just step by step, which in a way was like the spark that caused the fire that burned down the house.
I think
I think it was Bethany McLean that wrote one of the stories pointing that out. But David, you were going to say something.
Oh, no, I was just going to bring it back to the present a bit and start ask you about the seg funds mess. I mean, because at this stage we're, you know, butterfly flaps at wings, we're into a liquidity crisis and kind of an intensely confusing time within MF Global. What's your take on it? Do we blame Edith or John?
So if I was going to blame somebody, now, I would say, and I had this report from a couple MF Global personnel, and I remember specifically somebody telling me, you know, using customer seg funds intraday was allowed. And I said, I don't think you're allowed to touch customer seg funds ever. As it turns out, then, you know, when I dug through the trustees reports and other information about MF Global, it basically said so right there in one of the trustees reports. MF Global personnel believe that you could use customer seg funds intraday. In other words, if you needed to wire out $500 million in cash and Maybe MF Global didn't have that on hand at 8:30 in the morning when the FedWire opened, that they had money going in a customer SEG accounts anyway. They could use some of the customer SEG money to make their money wire in the beginning of the day. As long as that money was back in the customer SEG accounts by the end of the day, because by the end of the day was when, you know, your reports were filed and when you printed reports for accountants and regulators. So, you know, certainly if I was going to look at problems at MF Global in terms of managerial problems, would be the fact that I would dig through that and, you know, where did it come from that, that, SEG funds were allowed to be used during the day. Now, you know, what's really interesting with the SEG funds too was, and this is pretty much what happened. If you assume that, you know, that is true, that MF Global, you know, personnel use their customer SEG funds during the day, what happens during their bankruptcy week, basically the last full week in October of 2011, when MF Global is getting all sorts of margin calls from LCH ClearNet, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of New York, repo funding counterparties, and they're all asking for more margin because everybody knows that Lehman and Bear and all these other companies went bankrupt, and if you're going to liquidate your transactions with another company, you want to have as much cushion as you can, so you want to accumulate as much margin as you possibly can if you think somebody's going to go under. So all of MF Global's counterparties started asking them for more and more margin, and as they were sending out more and more margin to their clearing banks, central clearing counterparties, it was draining MF Global's liquidity. It was draining their resources. They didn't have enough cash. So what happened was that when MF Global personnel grabbed some of the customer money to send out for margin, they expected that there was other margin coming in from another counterparty, you know, later in the day. But as it turns out, once you got to about the Wednesday before they went bankrupt, that money wasn't coming back. In other words, they kept sending out margin for margin calls, but there wasn't, nobody was giving them any margin. So that's when the hole started to develop in the customer SEG funds, was basically that whole procedure that they have where they had been using intraday funds.
That's interesting because, there is obviously a gray area here that they should not have been using the SEG funds anyway. But the fact of the matter is that the sinkhole appeared because people were not, you know, they weren't, it wasn't being recycled back, which puts a lot of, I guess, culpability on the part of the CCPs and the custodians who were on the other side of that, would you say?
It's interesting because there's a very specific instance, which was a SEG fund transfer on Friday. And that's pretty much the most well-documented SEG fund transfer. And there's a little backstory to it, too, where it's very interesting because the day before in London was when JP Morgan Chase had a large margin call for MF Global in London. And MF Global in London, it was Thursday before MF Global went bankrupt, they decided, okay, you know, this is a crisis. We need our liquidity. And the FSA in London requires all London banks to have a backup liquidity that's held in, you know, very safe short-term securities. MF Global London had hundreds of millions of short-term securities in their account at Bank of New York, and they tried to access those securities. Basically, you know, I go through the whole process in the book, but nobody called them back. They kept calling personnel over there to release their backup liquidity funds, and they couldn't get their money. So in that case, the next morning, they called up MF Global in New York and said, you know, we can't get our liquidity in London. We need $175 million away. That's what sparked the, and I think somehow it also got to John Corzine, where John Corzine was notified that MF Global London needed cash right away. He called Edith O'Brien and said, now, of course, nobody knows exactly what was said because it wasn't done on a recorded phone line. If it was, we would certainly know about it because the trustees have had access to that for a while. So certainly that conversation never happened on a recorded phone line, but John Corzine said, get some money over to London. Mm-hmm. If you believe Edith O'Brien, she said that John Corzine knew she was going to use customer seg funds. If you look at what John Corzine said, he said that he knew nothing about using customer seg funds. He just ordered them to get funds over to London. So it was in that instance where it was clearly Edith O'Brien, you know, in 1 minute goes to JP Morgan Chase, withdraws $200 million worth of customer seg funds, and then minutes later sends $175 million over to MF Global London. JP Morgan Chase, Isabel, as you mentioned, noticed that, and they said, this really looks like the company's using their customer seg funds. So after that, the legal department at JP Morgan Chase sent a letter over to MF Global and said, we want you to confirm that you're not using your customer seg funds. Of course, that letter was never signed. It went back and forth a couple times, and there was a lot of confusion in the MF Global offices at the time. But in the end, Edith O'Brien refused to sign it.
In the book, you also mention like how the role Corzine played in Goldman's own post-94 revival, and how he helped to restructure
right.
the firm, make it more trade-focused. And that time, risk management was something that he was also pushing for, but then he had the guidance of Hank Paulson as well. So it seems that even though he was in charge of reinventing Goldman, by the time he came to Global, he had forgotten all that risk management side of the game. And more importantly, it sounds like he was going into a brokerage with the explicit sort of intention of basically transforming it into a mini investment bank and a Goldman Sachs risk-taking institution with its own proprietary trading arm and everything, which I find quite extraordinary. And I don't think I really appreciated that before I read the book, because, you know, this was during a time when there was already a crackdown on proprietary trading everywhere. And it caused him to think that this was an acceptable path to sort of improve the operations of and profitability of MF Global. And second, there's an anecdote in the book where you say that he was going around the floor looking at the broker business and just sort of saying, and it was almost like he didn't quite understand what brokers were, and he was sitting there watching them trade match client orders. And going, oh, no, but this should be a trade. We should be sending principal
more
at risk.
More
why
risk.
Aren't you using the flow? And why aren't you using the flow? We should be using this insight, this knowledge. And it's just, and you make out that this is like the insight he'd learned from Goldman Sachs and how, you know, using customer flows against them is perfectly legit.
In a way, you know, and I'm just speculating here, you know, maybe it was a little nostalgic for John Corzine. You know, perhaps, you know, he had a lot of glory years at Goldman Sachs. And, you know, in the 1990s, he was head of fixed income. He became senior partner. And kind of the backstory there is, you know, Goldman Sachs had a spectacular trading year in 1993, 1992, 1993. They had a terrible year in 1994. And that's when they, John Corzine, with the help of Hank Paulson, they got together and they put together a plan to turn Goldman around. And part of that plan was cutting expenses, was then after they kind of got rid of some excess personnel, was to hire new staff. Part of that plan was also speaking with the rating agencies, because at the time the rating agencies were about to cut Goldman Sachs' credit rating. And then it also, part of the plan was risk management. And that was pretty much at the forefront of risk management, because, you know, risk management was a topic that was discussed back then, and there were risk managers, but risk management wasn't as large a topic as it is now in banks. So Goldman Sachs was really kind of leading the industry then. So, you know, as you said, when John Corzine came back to MF Global after being in politics for a number of years, you know, and he had to turn around MF Global, you know, he looked at it as just the same as turning around Goldman.
He didn't notice the world had changed.
Almost 20 years ago. Right, exactly. Yeah. And you're right. Yeah, the world had changed. And what's really interesting, too, is that the playbook he pulled out of meeting with the rating agencies, cutting expenses, hiring traders, to use the same Goldman plan, but in the Goldman plan, there was emphasis on risk management. In the MF Global plan, there is no emphasis on risk management. So, you know, certainly the world of Wall Street and banks had changed a lot. And I think that, you know, I think that John Corzine really loved trading. He loved being a trader.
Well, you make him, he seems a bit addicted to it.
Oh, absolutely. I had reports from so many personnel who were saying that, you know, that's, you know, they were in meetings with John Corzine and he was, and you know, if you're ever in the conference room with a bunch of people and then you see somebody kind of, you know, looking down and maybe off to the side a little bit and you know that they're going through their BlackBerry, you know, or their phone, you know, looking at messages. And that is completely, what everybody, you know, was saying. You know, John Corzine was distracted. He was, you know, looking at market quotes constantly. And there's even points where, I believe J.C. Flowers intervened and said to John Corzine, you know, you're not really paying attention as a CEO as much as you should be. You're really doing a lot of trading. And that was, you know, that was what he wanted to do. He loved being a trader. And, you know, even initially about a year ago after the MF Global bankruptcy, news came out that John Corzine was planning on starting a hedge fund, which would certainly be much more along the lines of what he wants to do as opposed to being a CEO of a bank.
Fascinating. I guess we should be wrapping things up.
Okay, no, that's brilliant, Scott. Really, really interesting. And thank you for
Okay. Thank
you for coming on. We hope to have you on again at some point in the future.
David and Isabella, thank you very much for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'll come back anytime.
Thanks, Scott.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.